Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. My name is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. This episode is brought to you by OneCause, leader in online, mobile, and virtual fundraising software. OneCause supports over 6,000 nonprofits to reach more and raise more with innovative solutions. You can visit their virtual fundraising resource center at www.onecause.com. Hi, podcast listeners. Thank you for being thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm delighted to have Teresa, member of the Responsive Consulting team, with me co-hosting today. And we have our guest, Ellen. Ellen, would you mind introducing yourself to our listeners?
Sure, Jason. Thank you so much. It's my pleasure to be your featured guest today. My name is Ellen Sullivan, and I've been in the field for about 30 years of education. Mostly higher education administration, and most of that in fundraising. Today, my job is as the Director of International Advancement at Phillips Academy, which is an independent school in Massachusetts, founded in 1778.
Yeah, so Ellen, before we jump into our big conversation for today, can you unpack how, so I've been doing consulting in independent schools for quite some time myself. Can you unpack what you think is particularly unique about doing that work in the independent school space?
Yeah, sure. I'd be glad to take a stab at that. You know, for the first 26 or 27 years of my career, I worked in higher ed. So 21 years at Harvard and then 5 years at my own alma mater, Boston College. And when I moved to the independent school world, it was a shift in terms of focusing on the fact that the kids who are our students are kids. They're between the ages of 14 and 18. They're not considered independent adults, as was the case in the university setting. So I really have quite an arm's length distance from the students. I'm working to develop relationships with their parents along the lines of philanthropy and with alumni. But the students are not part of the equation for a very good reason. And that's quite different from my experience at the university setting, where I was often the advisor to the Chinese Student Association, the Latin American Business Club, and I sort of had a bridge to the families and the alumni through the current students. That's very different in the boarding school setting.
Right. Yeah. Good. Okay. So, So you and I could go down that path all day long, but we agreed to talk about something else. What was that big idea you were going to kick this conversation off with us?
Yeah. Thanks
for us. Yes.
Thanks for asking me. Yeah. So as I noodle over, you know, what is my kind of big theme that I think of as a guiding force in my fundraising efforts, I actually think of the word invitation, that essentially in this work, we are inviting people to be part of something that is important, something that is bigger than themselves. We are inviting them to find a way to have an impact or make a difference on the world. And it took me a while to really come to that sense. I remember in the early days of fundraising, this is 20 years ago, I was a brand new fundraiser at Harvard, and I was asked to reach out to an advisory board member and ask her to host a dinner for our organization, which was part of Harvard. And it was hard for me to do that. I thought, this is such a burden that I'm asking someone to host a dinner, because I thought if someone asked me, as then a 30-something with a small apartment, to host a dinner, that would be completely overwhelming. And it took me a while to remind myself, you know, this is a person who is not going to be making the canapés by herself in the kitchen. This is a person with a full household staff. And frankly, this is a person who has a bell that she can ring on the table when it's time for the servers to come and bring the second course. And that was just such a different world from the world that I inhabited as a fundraiser doing my level best. And I had to remind myself that in asking her to host this dinner, I was inviting her to be part of something. I was inviting her to take the leadership role. And I was creating for her an opportunity to do something on behalf of the organization. And not surprisingly, she was delighted to do it and didn't feel burdened and was thrilled that she could go to her favorite chef to bring him in for the event and her favorite florist. And it was sort of a marvel for me to witness all of that. But it was an important lesson for me.
One of the things that I know about you is that you literally have done fundraising all over the world, both representing the institutions you work for, but also training people in different countries around fundraising. What are some of the myths about international fundraising for those of us who have never traveled overseas to talk to people about philanthropy?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And Teresa is referencing the fact that I was quite involved in CASE, the Council for the Advancement and Support of Education. I was on the board for 5 years and I chaired the international committee. And through that, I had the opportunity to do a lot of voluntary training in Latin America. I did some in Africa. And I think the big myth out there, and the myth is really, in my experience, it's here in the U.S., that somehow America is the only philanthropic society on the planet, that we wrote the playbook for philanthropy. And when I give presentations, I often have an image of the IRS regulations from 1917, this is wartime, where for the very first time, there was a tax benefit offered to inspire philanthropic giving. And it was a part of a much larger war package. And so while it is true that for over 100 years, it has been written into the tax code here that philanthropic giving merits special consideration, it is also true that all around the world, we have examples of philanthropic giving that long predate our 1917 tax code revision. So if you look at the great universities of the UK, the University of Cambridge, founded in 1209, and the University of Oxford, founded even earlier, I think in 1096, you know, they're both well over 800 years old, and they can trace the history of giving to their very earliest days of existence. And my own work has involved me quite a bit in Latin America. And I remember a historian of Latin America saying to me, "Where do you think the money came from for the great cathedrals built throughout Latin America during the colonial era in the 16th and 17th century?" That money came from local people. We just didn't call it philanthropy, but that's what it was. And then in more recent times, I mean, I think you could argue for a generation now, about 25 years, schools and universities in Europe and increasingly Asia, Middle East, and Latin America have established formal fundraising efforts. So this idea that we are the only ones, and further, the erroneous idea that international parents and alumni and patients of our hospital and patrons of our museum wouldn't ever think about philanthropy because it's not part of their culture. That is, to my mind, just not accurate.
I agree. Years ago, when I was at MIT, we often had delegations from countries all over the world coming to see us to ask us, you know, they'd had a shift in how they were funding education and they were suddenly finding themselves in a position to be doing much more fundraising and they wanted to know how did MIT do it. So as a result, I have a lot of gifts from all over the world where people kindly came and asked our opinion and gave us something for it. Ellen, one of the other things I know you do is that you do travel all over the world to see parents and alumni of Phillips Andover. And I'm wondering, how are you handling things right now in that you can't travel and probably people don't want you to come see them in person?
That's right. Yeah, we like every institution I know, we do quite rightly have a travel ban in place now for both international and domestic travel. And also, you know, we've had a lot of conversations with colleagues across the country about never wanting to appear tone deaf to the harsh realities that face our friends and our families and cities around America and the world. And so one of the things that I found a way to do is to collaborate with colleagues in the admissions office. So anyone who works for a school or university right around now, mid-March, your school or university has probably just extended offers of admission to next year's class. And having worked in admission early in my career, I know very well that the admissions officers fight so hard for every single case, every single student who's admitted. And what they really want is for those students to say yes to the institution. And at this time of travel bans, no institution can do what they normally do, which is have an open weekend where they invite all the admitted kids to come with their parents, check out the school, stay overnight, join the chorus for a day, see if it's going to be the right fit for them. And so every institution is a bit on the back foot. How are we going to ensure that these kids who we desperately want in our class next year, because they're talented and they're tenacious and they're going to do well by our institution and do great things in the world, how are we going to get those kids? And so I've been working with my colleagues in the admissions office, and they've said, look, Ellen, you're in touch with international alumni and parents. Would you kindly reach out to our current parents and alumni and ask for their help in encouraging kids who were admitted from their local community, whether it's Jakarta or Singapore, Hong Kong, Buenos Aires, encourage them, reach out to them, answer any questions they may have, convey a sense of our school spirit to them, and encourage them to take the offer of admission. And so I've been doing that in the last few days, and it's sort of one little glimmer of positivity, to be perfectly honest, that when I reach out to alumni and parents and offer them something positive that they can do right at home in their own community on behalf of the school that we all love, they jump at the chance to do that. And they're delighted to report back. You know, I talked to the parents, I talked to the students, I connected them with other students, and they're going to say yes. And it's just a little bit of positive energy that goes a long way for everyone across the miles.
You know, Ellen, you were saying, so in my last book, I had written about this, that I probably referred to it as sort of an arrogance that Americans think that we sort of invented fundraising in the way that I remember. I think at the time when I was working on that project, I think the Kennedy Center, I was reading about what the Kennedy Center does in terms of people from around the world coming to the Kennedy Center to learn how to raise money. So I totally know where, and I can appreciate what both of you, Teresa and Ellen, have said about that. But I want to bring us, Ellen, I want to bring us back to this idea of an invitation, but I want to combine it with the international observations. And I want to acknowledge that, yes, other parts of the world do know how to raise money, and maybe even some of them know how to raise money better than us. Are there places in the world where you've seen fundraising done where they get that invitation better?
Well, I will say that I know, you know, CASE has had an office in London since 1994 because there's been sort of active fundraising taking place in the UK going back that far. I will say as a little criticism about UK-oriented fundraising, and I hope my UK friends will forgive me for this. Probably 10 years ago, I was at a conference around fundraising in the UK, and I heard some presenters talking about charities, and the word charity actually still has a great deal of currency in the UK. So the nonprofit sector is called the charity sector, and that alone actually is not something that inspires this idea of an invitation, right? Advancement is a term that I really like because I think it inspires intrigue. People want to know, what does that mean? How do I lean into that? What does it offer for me? What does it offer for the institution? And I find that sometimes terms that I encounter in sort of old school philanthropy, like the word charity, or you even hear people at conferences from time to time talk about begging bowls, B-E-G-G-I-N-G, B-O-W-L-S. And I find like this language is not helpful in elevating the conversation and extending an invitation. I did want to add something, if I might, that links this idea of an invitation with the observations that I have of international families at our school, and frankly, international families I knew at Harvard and Boston College. About 10 years ago, when I was at Harvard, there was this mistaken idea, to me it was a mistaken idea, that wealthy parents from abroad who pay full tuition would not be interested in supporting financial aid. Full stop. When I said, well, why do you think that? I was told by my colleagues, because they don't benefit from financial aid and their kids don't benefit from financial aid. And I remember thinking then that that's wrongheaded. And I have continued to think that for the last 10 years. And frankly, I would like to claim victory that I have demonstrated time and again that is completely wrongheaded. That in fact, as recently as a few months ago at Andover, I had a father from South Korea who paid full tuition because he could well afford it, say to me, "Ellen, I want you to know that our family believes that one of the greatest things about Phillips Academy is the need-blind admissions policy. And we understand that means that a kid of talent and tenacity, no matter what her family's financial circumstances, can A, be admitted, and B, be guaranteed the support she needs to be there." And he said, "Let me tell you about my daughter's roommate. My daughter is from a very privileged family in Korea. She's gone on wonderful holidays all her life. Every resource has been available to her. But do you know where her roommate is from? She's from inner city Newark. She's on a very particular program called the New Jersey Scholars. And do you know about that program, Ellen?" And I was completely caught off guard because, no, I have no earthly idea what this New Jersey Scholars program is. It's not something in my orbit. He said, "Let me tell you. Through this program, you have to have a family income of less than $38,000 a year. Now, Ellen, you know very well that the average income in America for families with college-going children is $54,000. So $38,000 is significantly less than that." And he went on and on and on that he had made it a point to understand what this girl's circumstance was. And he was so moved and proud that this school, where he is delighted to send his daughter for a first-class education, has made a commitment to this girl, the roommate, who comes from such completely different circumstances. And he said, "I would be happy to support that at Andover, because this is something I cannot give my daughter. I cannot give her access to this world of people whose lives are completely different. And she has learned so much from being in communion with her roommate." And I've heard that story time and again from international parents. So I'd just like to do a shout out to colleagues who might have thought that they shouldn't dare utter a word about financial aid to full paying parents.
Right.
I think you would be wise to think about it.
So it's interesting that you talk about the quote unquote charity sector in the United Kingdom. I remember, again, I'm referring to this book project that I worked on a couple of years ago, and I remember interviewing two fundraising leaders in the United Kingdom, I think both of which were Americans who had moved over there to, you know, lead large programs. I want to say one of them was at one of the colleges at Cambridge, and then I think someone else was at the London School. And they both remarked the same thing. They both sort of made the same distinction that in the United Kingdom, they have sort of embedded this disadvantaged distinction. They've sort of drawn a line in the sand that doesn't work to the quote unquote charity sectors, the smaller charities, if you will, advantage, because higher education sort of knows and plays they get how philanthropy and fundraising really works, I guess you could say. But one of the things they also pointed out, which is what I'm interested in, where I was going with this, is they also pointed out that Americans were not, they were admired for sort of bringing this insight, knowledge, and, you know, we know what we're doing, but that they didn't acclimate really well. I remember it was the gentleman I was speaking to, I think I want to say he came from Ohio State or somewhere. And I think he lasted a couple of years. He had to go back because he just couldn't adapt. Have you heard that narrative in other places?
You know, I have. And so it was probably 10 years ago that I was at this conference I was speaking of in the UK. And there was a whole, you know, proliferation of U.S. trained fundraisers appearing at institutions across the UK, and there still is. And it seemed as though at the time the attitude was better get the Americans to do this distasteful work because brash and they're bold, and we can just stay behind the scenes and pretend it wasn't us, but it was this brash and bold American thing because we need these resources, but we don't want to diminish ourselves or our standing or something. And so, yes, I think this is a long distance observation that perhaps is unfair because I haven't lived in the UK during these times and I haven't been part of that experience. But my sense was this is a necessary evil. We need these brash and bold and loud people to sort of raise a lot of money and then, like, please go away and don't ruin our cultural context. that's an old notion. I wouldn't say that it exists today, but there definitely was this sense that we need to get them to do this work. A, because they're trained to do it, because, you know, America has almost 100 years of experience in sort of formal fundraising work at institutions. But B, because this is not culturally aligned with who we are as a people. That used to be the sense that was emanating. And maybe that has changed. I don't know.
So I it's funny. We'll shift our attention away from our friends over in the UK, and we'll bring it to our friends north of us in Canada. So I was doing a seminar maybe 18 months ago, and I have this framework that I teach of five questions, and I want to say it must have been the third or fourth question in this framework that it's kind of a question, a keyword outline that I use to coach development officers in that first meeting, that initial meeting. And it kind of, as I teach it, the whole idea is the idea of sort of teeing up this relationship in a good way so that it goes in the direction you want it to go for subsequent meetings. And I remember the third or fourth question, the fourth question being the one that actually brings up money, not for the purpose of asking for money, but allowing money to be a part of the conversation. So the question is something along the lines of, what other type of organizations do you support, or something like that. And I think it's our very polite Canadian friends that were in the room with me that said, that's just too bold. You know, you're pushing the envelope too far. Have you found that, and this is not an international question so much, but that notion of sort of getting money on the table, sort of getting that into the relationship, is a helpful way to get our job done. I have just always found that to be a very, regardless of who the constituent was on the other side of the table, be they an independent school or an international audience or something, it's that idea of sort of letting the conversation, letting the relationship incorporate money as a very natural part of what we're talking about.
You
follow my thinking?
I do follow your thinking. And at Boston College, we had some training that helped us to think about something similar to this five questions rubric for fundraisers. And definitely the question, what other type of organizations do you support, was part of that meaningful engagement. And frankly, I see that working more effectively with Americans who are accustomed to having philanthropy around them, who know that, you know, the Harvard College Fund was established in 1928. Like, this stuff has been around for our grandparents to be part of. I think in my experience, for international families, there's perhaps a higher level of privacy around philanthropy. In a similar way, I remember being in Korea a couple of years ago with some Boston College parents, and it was right around the time that admissions decisions were announced. And as you know, in America, this is the topic of conversation. If you are the parent of a high school senior, this is who's planning to go to college, this is the topic of conversation over your household and your friends and your neighborhood for a year. In Korea, I said to them, you know, do you talk about this? And they said, never. We wouldn't discuss, you know, where's your child going? Did he apply to Princeton? These are private family things. And that was sort of a shock to me. And I feel as though in the same way, there's a higher level of privacy around philanthropy. So I don't find myself asking families abroad, unless they're very sort of oriented to the West, attended university here. I don't tend to ask them what other organizations they support. I ask them more about how they feel about our institution. And I feel like I can come to the same conclusion most of the time.
So you can get, you have found other ways, other pathways to get essentially to the same place.
I have. And with the parents of kids at our school, it's often asking them to reflect on their children's experience, what has been meaningful to their kids. And that's a great opener.
Yeah. Something that also occurs to me, something you said earlier, it must be the invitation. It's back to your invitation idea. So someone asked, one of the, I've been coaching a woman in New York City for, I don't know, about a year now. And earlier this week, she was asking me, you know, given the corona, you know, COVID-19 sort of reality in our world right now, and the fact that everybody's mind's on that, is now an appropriate time to ask? And one of the things I said to her is, I said, regardless of what was going on in the world, I have always incorporated this practice of asking the donor while in the meeting if now would be an appropriate time, or may we talk about, or, you know, asking essentially permission to have the conversation, so as to allow, so as to demonstrate that we're putting the relationship ahead of the negotiation of a gift, and ensuring that if the person says, if the donor says, no, now is not, probably not a right time, then we can immediately sort of shift gears, continue with the conversation in another direction, and come back to it. Have you ever found a practice like that that is particularly helpful in sort of knowing that the, you know, kind of testing the waters?
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. Asking the donor if now is the right time to have the conversation, or in my case, as I'm doing fundraising from afar much of the time. So in normal circumstances, of course, I'd have 7 or 8 international trips a year. These are not normal circumstances. So in these circumstances, sometimes what I'm doing with outreach to people with whom I have had a conversation about imagining a gift, I might reach out and say, would you be willing to consider receiving a proposal for your consideration? And I, Teresa and I have talked about this. I'm a big believer in an actual written proposal. It doesn't have to be long. It doesn't have to be dense. But it's a lot easier for someone to put off the notion if it's merely a notion. Ellen asked me 18 months ago if I'd think about a gift. I said, yeah. Ellen asked me 12 months ago. I said, oh, sure, next time. But it's a lot harder to put it off if it's not just a notion, if it's an actual physical thing that is sitting on the dining room table gathering dust. There it is. It's a reminder that she asked us to think about this seriously. And I have found in my experience that more often than not, if someone agrees to receive my proposal, he or she will then ultimately agree to make a significant gift.
You and I have been, I mean, we're almost like, I don't know what the expression is. I don't have the right expression, but
first,
Ellen, you and I think so much alike. So I have this rule that I teach. So I have these deliberate practices that I teach major gift officers. And one, and the last of the 4-5 deliberate practices is the idea that a solicitation is always asked in person and on paper. So it's an articulation and a rearticulation of what is being asked for. And it's always in recognition that oftentimes we make these asks in person, say over the lunch table or in the office or something, or the living room, and they're not clearly articulated, or they're forgotten, or they're misunderstood. And so I have found that the development officer who knows that they have to not only ask in person, but they also have to go, they know that they have to go back to the office in order to get the quote unquote job done. They have to also rearticulate exactly what was discussed and put it on paper, ensures from a mastery standpoint, because I'm trying to, you know, teach this major gift officer how to become very talented at this stuff, that they need to not only clearly articulate it in person, but also be able to similarly articulate it on paper.
Well said.
Yeah. Yeah. Teresa, what's your thoughts on this? I have kind of hijacked the conversation, but Ellen and I were just having too much fun. What's your thoughts here on the idea of invitation, international? We've gone all over the place. Ellen, you're terribly eloquent on this stuff.
Well, I agree with your last point about recording all of your solicitations in the form of proposals. And I was surprised as I came through my fundraising career that not everybody did that. And I inherited a couple of shops that didn't do that historically. And there was a misunderstanding with donors, or donors didn't understand the pledge cycle when they were paying off their gifts. Worse yet, sometimes the gift wasn't being used in the manner that it was intended because nobody had written it down. So that's imperative. In terms of invitation, I love that notion, Ellen. I think it warms up what we're asking people to do, is that we're really asking people to stand side by side with us and not across from us. And when you're inviting somebody to do something with you, it is literally with you, not for you or at you. That's a lovely way to think about our work. So thank you for sharing that.
Ellen, what is your, what's your thoughts about messaging right now? You're so accustomed to doing the type of work that Teresa and I are similarly accustomed to doing. And that is these table, you know, across the table type conversations with major donors. And I've been similarly having conversations with people who, like, for instance, I had someone on the podcast recently who does a lot of direct response. And so we were talking about messaging and that sort of stuff. But when we're in a situation like this, how do we incorporate that invitation and also be sensitive to sort of the current reality in our world? And a number of people, when I've asked that sort of a question, have sort of brought us back to like September 11th and said, call on that, sort of stir up that, what you recall about September 11th, and not to sort of like play that card and be manipulative with the emotionalism that comes with instances like that. Anyway, what's your thoughts about it? Before we let you go, what's your thoughts about the messaging that we're conveying right now?
Yeah, this is a challenging one, because one wants to be sensitive and you almost can't be too sensitive. You know, just last night, a friend texted and said his next door neighbor is a Boston Celtics player who's just tested positive. And this is the next door neighbor. And you think about the elevator button and the door. And so who knows? So one can't be too sensitive. One should be 10 times more sensitive than one even thinks is necessary. And yet, at the same time, sometimes these wonderful surprises are waiting for us. So I think I'll address the question with an illustrative example. There's an alum of our school from the 90s. He lives in Asia. He hasn't been what we would generally describe as a big donor. He's been a modest donor, but one imagines that much more could happen. Okay, I'll just put it that way. So I started reaching out to this person about 18 months ago, inviting him to things, like personally, there I go, inviting him to things, like personally reaching out and saying, we'd love to have you come. You know, I think you'd be pleasantly surprised. Some of your classmates have been there. A trustee is hosting the small dinner. I thought it would be really nice for the group from the 90s to have a chance to hear from the trustee. And so I kind of summoned him out, and he came. And he was very affable and said, you know, it's been a long time. I'm sorry I've been disengaged, but thank you for reaching out. Thank you for inviting me. You remind me how much this place means to me. So fast forward in the fall, we were in conversation, and I said, do you think you would be willing to receive a proposal for a scholarship? We had talked in vague terms about this before, but I hadn't asked him directly, would you consider a proposal? And he said, I'm not really sure. It might be beyond me, but you know, maybe I could talk to my family. And okay, why don't you go ahead and send it? So I sent it. Well, last week, this person, who, by the way, lives in a country that suffered through this crisis 2 and 3 months before we did, and experienced lockdown, and experience lots of financial hardships in society. A week ago, he came back to me and he said, you know, I talked to my parents about this, and we decided we're going to create the scholarship together, my parents and I, because this institution meant so much to me. And you inviting me to that dinner 18 months ago, it really brought it back to me. And so thank you for that. And thank you for reaching out. And we're talking about an endowed scholarship. I mean, this is a wonderful, wonderful thing for us. And so sometimes there are these wonderful moments of surprise that you never saw coming. And it kind of affirms that the relationship model of reaching out, of inviting, of encouraging, of waiting for the right moment, of asking if this is the right moment, all of that is critical to our success in this work.
Ellen, if people know how to find me, they know how to find Teresa. If someone is listening today and they've listened to everything that you've shared about the idea of an invitation, about international fundraising, and they're interested in reaching out to you, how would you suggest that they do that?
I think the best way is just on LinkedIn. You'll find me there. So it's Ellen Sullivan, and I'm at Phillips Academy in Massachusetts.
It's certainly been a pleasure. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Ellen. Great to be talking to you.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.